Hello, music lovers. Deborah Lynn here, composer, conductor, and professor. You're listening to What's the Score, a podcast about music and the brilliant people who create it. This podcast celebrates Independence Day in the USA with an exploration of the drum and fife signals and marches that helped us emerge triumphant from the Revolutionary War. But first, today's composer quote. I don't care what you say about me, as long as you say something about me, and as long as you spell my name right. George M. Cohan. This week in music history, a.k.a. mostly composer birthdays. June 28, 1846, Adolph Sax patented his saxophone. In 1902, Richard Rogers was born in New York City, and in 1955, Thomas Hampson was born in Elkhart, Indiana. June 29th was the birth date of Lena Horne in 1917. She was born in Brooklyn, New York. It's also the birth date of Martin Mailman, wonderful composer who was born in New York City in 1932. In 1951, bassist Stanley Clark was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. June 29th is also the date in 2015 when Misty Copeland became the first African-American principal dancer of the American Ballet Theater. June 30th, 1888, was the first known recording of classical music, and it was made on wax cylinder. The piece was Handel's Israel in Egypt. June 30th, 1901, was the birth date of Nelson Eddy. He was born in Providence, Rhode Island. In 1908, Leroy Anderson was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In 1910, Frank Lesser was born in New York City. 1911, Bernard Herrmann was born in New York City. And boy, it was a strange day for rock and roll also. In 1967, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones received a one-year jail sentence on marijuana and amphetamine charges. A similar thing happened again on the same day in 1971. They were both arrested on marijuana charges again. Boys, just find something else to do on June 30th. In 2000, Eminem's mother took him to court in a $10 million lawsuit claiming defamation of character for several song lyrics, including "My mother smokes more dope than I do." This might make a great opera libretto. I'll have to think about that. July 1st, 1935, James Cotton was born in Tunica, Mississippi. In 1941, Twyla Tharp was born in Portland, Indiana. In 1942, Andre Crouch was born in San Francisco, California. In 1945, Deborah Harry of Blondie was born in Miami, Florida. And in 1967, on July 1st, the Beatles album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band hit number one in the U.S. and stayed there for 15 weeks. Also, July 1st, 1980, O Canada officially became the national anthem of Canada. July 2nd, 1714, Christoph Willibald Gluck was born in Erasbach, Germany. And in 1819, Charles-Louis Hanon was born in Rodescure, France. And he's the guy that wrote all those piano exercises. So if you've taken piano lessons and you remember playing Hanon, you might not be celebrating his birthday so much today. Anyway, July 2nd, 1914, Frederick Fennell was born in Cleveland, Ohio. On July 3rd, 1643, Alessandro Stradella was born in Bologna, Italy. In 1854, Leoš Janáček was born in, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can pronounce this, Hukvaldi, Moravia. Sorry if I said that wrong for all of you wonderful Moravians out there. In 1878, on July 3rd, George M. Cohan was born in Providence, Rhode Island. In 1930, Tommy Tedesco was born in Niagara Falls, New York. And in 1950, Damon Harris of the Temptations was born in Baltimore, Maryland. And that brings us to July 4th. 1826, Stephen Foster was born in Lawrenceville, PA. And in 1938, Bill Withers was born in Slab Fork, West Virginia. And in 1995, Post Malone was born in Syracuse, New York. Independence Day to my fellow U.S. citizens out there. You're going to hear some of my favorite little drum and fife tunes throughout this podcast episode. And that one that you just heard was called Drowsy Maggie. I attended a lovely concert in the park yesterday with my family. My spouse was playing cello with the Warsaw, Indiana Symphony of the Lakes, after which we got to see some fireworks. So we had a pretty nice little celebration. I hope that you did too. About 10 years ago, I was composing an oratorio entitled A Family Portrait. And if you've listened to some of my previous broadcasts, you know about that piece. It included settings of letters from three members of the same family, one of whom was a Civil War soldier in the Union Army. He wrote to his parents describing all the goings-on at his military camp in Manassas, Virginia. I wanted to include some drum and fife music in order to conjure up images for the audience of Army regiments marching through daily drills. So for my composition, I used the Civil War tune Tenting Tonight because my letter author mentioned sitting in his little tent and just coming off from dress parade. So I composed a drum and fife rendering of Tenting Tonight, and then I had the men's chorus sing it in the original version a little bit later. And all of this served as a backdrop for the soloist who sang the text of the soldier's letter. Before I began work on that movement, I decided to dig deep into the history of the military drum and fife tradition so I could create an accurate aural atmosphere. Like most Americans, the first image that came to my mind was Archibald Willard's famous painting, The Spirit of 76, created in Cleveland, Ohio, during the year of our nation's centennial. I knew that a primary function of Civil War musicians was to provide ceremonial music, entertainment, and raise the morale of soldiers when times were bleakest. What I didn't know was how this tradition began and how it had changed over the years. If the familiar painting was accurate, why were there only two drummers and one fifer in the Revolutionary era instead of a full band, which was common during the Civil War? Well, I eventually found the answer to that question and many more, and I wasn't particularly a fan of drum and fife music then, but I sure am now. That was The Boys of Blue Hill. The first documented use of drums and fifes was by the Swiss Army during the Battle of Sempach way back in 1386. In the heat of battle, military commanders could not make their spoken orders heard by all their soldiers at the same time. So they created a system of signals to be played on drums and fifes. These instruments had a far greater carrying power over clanking broadswords and screaming warriors than the human voice. So the musicians and the soldiers learned to distinguish between all these various signals, lest they inadvertently march or fire their weapons in the wrong direction, endangering everyone and potentially losing a battle. The fife pitches were not as discernible as the various drum beats, so it was the rhythm of each signal that was significant, not the tunes themselves. The 14th century Swiss drummers had no established form of notation for these various signals, so when they needed to apprentice a new group of drummers, they described the various signals using onomatopoeic words and phrases. This is how we ended up with terms like flam, tap, roll, stroke roll, drag, ratamacue, flamadiddle, and paradiddle. Those became the standard terms for rudiments of drumming. As the Swiss engaged with other armies, both inside and outside their borders, news of their drum and fife signaling system spread quickly, making its way to England, where it became standard practice. Naturally, the system came right on over to our shores with the North American colonists. That was the ever-popular The Girl I Left Behind. Drums and fifes were easily portable, and their timbre could pierce the air better than most other instruments. During the Revolutionary conflict, the Americans were so outnumbered that it wouldn't be practical for men to fill up an entire band. Every able-bodied man was needed to fire a musket or brandish a bayonet. Who ended up playing the drums and fifes? Well, as depicted in Willard's painting, they were usually young boys or old men who were not considered to be of fighting age. For large-scale conflicts, several drummers and fifers would be stationed across the battlefield. The one nearest the commanding officer would receive that order from him and begin playing the appropriate signal, as the other musicians would join in with him, essentially passing it along from one musician to the other until it reached the ears of all the soldiers. There were signals for every possible marching and battle command: to arms, charge, retreat, fix bayonets, ceasefire, about face, right turn, left turn, march faster, march slower, etc. There were also commands for the artillery that would be given in quick succession so they knew when to load, take aim, prepare, and fire. There are a couple of inaccuracies in Willard's painting, though. One is the flag shown in the background. That particular flag design came much later than the Revolutionary conflict. The other inaccuracy involves the way the musicians are dressed. Soldiers wore blue coats with red facings, so the drummers and fifers wore the opposite, red coats with blue facings. There are a couple of reasons for this. One was that in the smoke-ridden confusion of battle, commanders needed to be able to find the musicians quickly to begin relaying their orders. The musicians needed to stand out from the soldiers. This also helped the opposing army identify the unarmed musicians and hopefully avoid targeting them during battle. You may be wondering, how did bugles come into the picture? And that is a very good question. Drums and fifes worked great with the infantry, but they were impossible to play on horseback, so eventually bugles became the signaling instrument for the cavalry because they could be played with one hand while holding the reins of a horse with the other. Was Patty at the handcar, and yep, you heard some bugles in there. Good ears. Even though Gutenberg's 1440 printing press helped standardize music notation, interestingly, none of these military drum and fife signals had been compiled, printed, and distributed by the start of the American Revolution. Each regiment had its own set of signals developed by their own musicians. If soldiers or drummers moved from one regiment to another, you can imagine the confusion that would result. They would often, and quite literally, get their signals crossed. After 2 years of this disorganized mayhem, General Washington appointed Frederick von Steuben the task of creating rules for all his regiments, including a set of signals for all drummers and fifers. His Regulations for the Order and Discipline of the Troops of the United States was adopted by Congress on March 29, 1779. It included the Camp Duty, which was a list of all the drum beats everyone had to learn to recognize from Reveille at sunrise to the Tattoo at bedtime. Here are just a few from that list for which I could find recordings. The reveille was to sound or beat at daybreak, and this is the signal for the men to rise. And the manual also says it's also time for the sentinels to leave off challenging. According to von Steuben's manual, the drummer's call shall be beat a quarter of an hour before the time of beating, when the drummers will assemble before the colors of their respective battalions. Upon a Trencher was the tune that signaled breakfast. Assembly was basically the time when men would gather for roll call, and they would also receive their working orders for the day. The hoisting of the colors was when the flag was raised, and Yankee Doodle soon became the standard tune, but any long march could be played here. If that tune seemed a little off base, it's because that's the original Yankee Doodle tune. It didn't come into the form that we know and love today until much later. The fatigue was played as a signal for those on duty to begin their work. This was also the signal for idle women to leave the camp. The roast beef was the signal for the noon meal. Retreat was when men could cease their work and rest or enjoy some recreation. This was also the same signal used when the men were ordered to retreat on the battlefield. The lowering of the colors, which was when the flag was taken down, was accompanied by Hail Columbia. The tattoo signals lights out. Men are to go to their tents and remain there until morning. The term tattoo is derived from the Dutch word taptoe, which means shut the tap. In other words, stop drinking. Various duty calls were short drum strokes that signaled work assignments or duties, like chopping wood or carrying water. The general was played to signal the striking of tents, and also was a marching tune. There was also the church call, which signaled the men to assemble for a religious service. This was the same signal for parley on the battlefield, which meant that a flag of truce had been spotted near the enemy's lines. And of course, there was the Rogue's March, which was played to drum out soldiers who were unworthy of further service. Is also in the mix, but at this time it merely signaled a slowdown at the front of the line and was primarily a slow drum beat. The bugle tune taps didn't come into use for military funerals and signaling the end of the day's activities until the Civil War. Obviously, these signals were vital to the success of every regiment, so in order to entice boys and old men to join the fray, armed only with musical instruments, mind you, they were paid more than the soldiers. Wow. Nowadays, it's really rare to find musicians at the top of the payroll. In addition to all those signals, there were hundreds of marching tunes, because these guys traveled long distances on foot. Since the United States was still pretty young, most of the marching tunes played by our army were also being played by the British. Why? Because England is where most of our marches originated. This is a much bigger topic than what I had time to discuss in one podcast, but I hope this gives you a rudimentary overview of the subject. Perhaps I've piqued your curiosity to look up more Revolutionary War music. If so, I would recommend recordings by the United States Army Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps, headquartered in Washington, D.C., as well as the Colonial Williamsburg Fifes and Drums in Williamsburg, Virginia. I've also posted some of my favorite YouTube links on the page for this podcast, episode 23, at my blog site, deborahlynnmusic.org. To end this episode, I thought it might be fun to share with you one final march, which was composed right here in the colonies by William Billings. It's one that you heard a snippet of earlier, but I'm going to play the whole thing for you now. And it's called Chester. It was a favorite among soldiers who would sing along as they marched. And once again, happy Independence Day. Thanks for tuning in to What's the Score? This is Deborah Lynn signing off. If you'd like to know more about me or my compositions, wander on over to my blog site, deborahlynnmusic.org.